The date is January 26, 2010, and we are at the Amelia Island Museum of History, 233 South 3rd Street in Fernandina Beach, Florida. The following interview is being conducted as a part of the Amelia Island Museum of History's Veterans History Project in partnership with the Library of Congress. We are interviewing Ollie S. Swenson, date of birth August 18, 1931, in St. Petersburg, Florida. My name is James McCannell, and I will interview the subject on behalf of the Amelia Island Museum of History. Assisting me is Gerhard Tam, who will operate the recording equipment. I will now begin the interview. Okay, Ollie, if you would.
It's pronounced Ole.
Ole, oh, I'm sorry. Ole,
yeah.
You want to start over again?
No, can't.
Okay. I'm sorry, Ole. What was your period of service?
I went in October of 52 and left the Air Force at October of 57.
Okay.
So then 5 years.
And during which conflicts did you serve?
Korean.
Okay, during the Korean conflict. And then what was your highest rank achieved?
First lieutenant.
Okay. And where did you serve?
I have served in Kunsan Air Base, Korea. It was number K-8. Mm-hmm. And just out of the town of Kunsan.
Okay. And can you tell us how you first became involved in military service?
Yes, I can. I was a student at the University of Florida, and as you know, the university is a civilian contract school and a land-grant school, and the government required that all male students take 2 years of ROTC. And I didn't realize this when I went there, and they asked me what I would like to serve in, you know, and I had no idea. And so they put me in artillery, you know. And we had a class, and we'd have marching every Thursday and lining up all the guns with the aiming circle and everything, and did all that. And then after doing that for 2 years, I decided, well, this wasn't for me, you know. I was not interested in artillery.
Sure.
So I dropped out of the ROTC, and the next year, I was in my third year at the University of Florida, the draft board started to get me. So I decided to take the Stanine tests at Moody Air Force Base in Valdosta, and it was 2 days of testing, all kinds of testing. And I did qualified for pilot training, and that's how I got into it to begin with.
And this was in 1952?
Yes.
Okay. So then where did you first enter the Air Force?
Went to pre-flight training at Lackland Air Force Base in Lubbock, Texas.
What was that like?
It was very difficult because we were happened to be the first class to go through pre-flight at Lackland, which I understand they're still using that school. Mm-hmm. And we didn't have any senior class to give us a hard time. We had all these TAC officers, and they would just catch you by yourself somewhere and you had to recite all of these, general orders and all of those things, you know, and different little jingles that you had to recite when they asked you, trying to put a lot of pressure on you to see if you could stand pressure, I would imagine. The courses there were just trying to make you an officer, you know, mm-hmm. so that you understand the traditions and all of that. And
military courtesy.
Yeah, right.
Did you have to stand a lot of inspections?
Every day.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, they would really get me because I was a civilian, and I didn't have my uniform like a lot of the other guys were in the Air Force, and then they went into this,
mm-hmm.
and they would see me standing there in civilian clothes in the ranks. And really get all over me, boy. Then it became better when I was issued my fatigues and everything, mm-hmm. you know. But we had to get up at something like 5 in the morning and go out and stand inspection and then come back in get our bed made up so that you could bounce a quarter on the, you know, and make sure that all of your uniforms that were hanging up were buttoned on the right side and everything. And
so did they have some kind of demerit criteria?
Oh, certainly did. In fact, I got so many demerits that I was walking tours, you know, as a matter of fact, one of the presidents was inaugurated while we were there. I forget which one it was, and my class marched in that parade, but I couldn't go because I was walking tours.
Can you explain what walking tours is?
Well, every weekend, which you would ordinarily have off, and at a certain point, maybe even go into town, you know, which was a big treat. Mm-hmm. And when you were walking off tours, you had to show up on Saturday and Sunday, at a field and start on one side, walk all the way across the field, and then turn around, and walk all the way back for couple of hours or so.
So this was a punishment?
Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. How was the food there at Lackland?
It was very good. We even had the cadets had a supplement that they prepared and even a better type of food than the regular Air Force personnel that were worked there.
Hmm. Now, during the pre-flight, did you do any flying at all?
No.
Pre-flight?
No,
that was... How long did pre-flight last?
I think it was 6 months.
Uh-huh. So, and that was all at Lackland?
Yeah.
Now, when you got out of pre-flight, did you remain at Lackland, or did you move on to some other base?
No, then I was... went into flight school at Marana Air Force Base in Tucson, Arizona.
Uh-huh.
And the first plane that they had to fly there was a PA-18, which is a little Piper Cub. And I soloed in 8 hours, so then that qualified me to go into the T-6.
Tell me about your solo experience. What were you feeling the first time you took off without an instructor?
Oh, it was a very nice feeling, not having somebody in there barking at you, you know.
So you knew you were going to be able to land that aircraft the first time.
Oh, sure.
No problem.
Yeah, I didn't have any problem flying either the T-6 or the little one.
So after you soloed, then, is that when you transitioned to the T-6s, or did you have more time in the 18?
No, we went right into the T-6 and did all kinds of, learned all kinds of acrobatics and instrument training under a hood. You would have an instructor in the front seat and you'd be in the back seat, and they have this hood that would come over, and all you could see was your instruments. Mm-hmm. So you got your instrument training that way.
Did you get an official, I guess it was it CAA back then or FAA? You get an instrument ticket?
No, I did. I got that when I got out of the service.
Oh, I see. Yeah. Okay. Well, let's see. After you got all the flight time in the AT-6s, did you then move to another airbase to transition to multi-engine aircraft?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Where did you go then?
I went to Reese Air Force Base.
Where was that?
And I think that was in San Antonio.
San Antonio, okay.
And flew with the B-25, the old bomber that they used in World War II. Learned multi-engine in that. We had a choice after we left the primary school. We had a choice as to go into single engine or multi. And I kind of thought like I would use this so that I could use multi-engine experience to go into airline, be hired for the airlines.
Mm.
So that's why I chose them.
I see. So then, after you flew the B-25s, first of all, how long was that time period?
That must have been about 6 months, also.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Did they loosen up on you any? I mean, it wasn't.
Oh yeah.
You didn't have the same tight experience like in flight school, huh?
No, the it was a lot easier. As a matter of fact, we took a cross-country trip. There would be two of us and an instructor, two students and instructor. We took a cross-country to New York, landed at LaGuardia there. And the other man that I was with had parents there, and we went and visited them. We had spent a very nice weekend there. He took me around to all the bars and everything, you know, and we had experiences like that. Then after that multi-engine training, I went to Enid, Oklahoma for B-26 training. And there again, I must have been there about 6 months. And when I graduated that, got my commission and everything, then I went right over to Korea.
Now, how did you get to Korea? Was it on board ship, or did they fly you? Or?
No, I flew in something like a C-47 or a C-46.
Uh-huh.
Just as part of the cargo, you know. And
you flew into where in Korea?
Well, I flew first to Japan, and I stayed there until I had a flight to Korea.
Mm-hmm.
And it was strange because it was in another ship the same, and I was the only one on the ship.
Huh.
So we landed at K-8 in Korea, and that's where I must have been there 6 months also. flying all kinds of missions. Fortunately or unfortunately, I never had to use any of my gunnery experience or my bombing in Korea, because I got over there about the same time they were having the talks in Panmunjom and set up the 38th parallel. We just couldn't fly above the 38th parallel, but we were still flying all of the missions. We called them route recces. We flew at night over there. Mm-hmm. And when the jet aircraft would go in the daytime, we would come out and fly those same routes, and then for trains coming through and vehicles coming through, which we could shoot up if necessary. But
so were these like surveillance flights? Were you looking for enemy activity?
Well, we didn't expect to find any, but we would just practice they're still at war over there.
Yeah.
And if it had reoccurred, we did all kinds of missions, like we work with GCI sites that would direct us into a target, tell us when to open the bomb bays and when to drop the bombs. Mm-hmm. And so even in weather or anything, the enemy never knew the bomb would come out of the air. And one thing I remember about flying over there was that there was no horizon at night. Like in the States, where you have towns with lights and everything, and when you left the runway lights, that was it. You had to fly instruments the whole time. Because there was no visual reference whatsoever. So it would cause you to have every now and then you'd get a pretty good case of vertigo. You know, you'd be flying along and you'd see a cloud out here and no cloud over here, and you'd think, well, any two senses confused will cause you to have vertigo. And I had it several times at night flying.
I was going to ask you, when you did get vertigo, how did you regain your equilibrium?
Just follow the instruments.
Just believe those instruments.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Well, what were your accommodations like over there?
We had pretty nice accommodations. The people that built the runway, it was an 8,000-foot runway, and the people that constructed that had built little houses all along in a certain way from the runway. And they were 2 and 3 bedrooms, you know, and a kitchen. And of course, we never used the kitchen at all. We had little Korean girls come in and make our beds and do that type of thing. And I remember this one night we were thinking it'd be nice to have a cup of coffee, and we went into the kitchen and looking for a coffee can, and we opened this can and the most ungodly smell came out, and we realized it was kimchi.
Oh no.
Kimchi. The girls ate kimchi for lunch and everything when we...
Can you explain what kimchi is?
Well, from what I understood, it's they take an earthen pot and put any kind of animal that they have, can find, dog, cat, pig, and bury it in the ground. And when it ferments and becomes nice and black, that's when they consume it. Mm-hmm. Let me see.
What was?
Also had sauerkraut and
oh yeah, that, so. Okay. But you had a mess hall, didn't you?
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Uh huh.
So that's
yeah. We had a nice officers club.
Uh-huh.
And a nice mess hall. It's just that the food was terrible because, like, eggs were reconstituted eggs, you know, just powder, and they'd put water in with them. And the food really wasn't that satisfying.
I was going to ask you also, what's the size of the crew on a B-26? How many people?
Well, we have the pilot, of course, and then in the right seat is a navigator, also an officer. And then in the jump seat in the back, a flight engineer, an enlisted man, and then the gunner in the back, an enlisted man. We didn't have any access to the gunner in the back. There was the Bombay was in between, and when he got in the plane, he just stayed there. You know,
so he was isolated.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we just had communication with him on the radio, and just find out how he's doing every now and then. You know.
Did you ever have any emergency situations flying?
No. Everything was. I had a few when I started flying jets, but other than that, it was all pretty safe flying.
Oh, that's good. Now, how long were you in Korea?
6 months.
6 months, okay.
Yeah, we moved back. I was with the 8th Bomb Squadron in Korea. And we after the after the what would you call it? Not an armistice, but a ceasefire, I guess.
End of hostilities.
Yeah, end of hostilities, and then the whole squadron moved back to Johnson Air Force Base in Japan, and that was really a treat because Korea. I think I went into town at the Kuntan one time, and the streets weren't paved. It was real dirty, and then all the honey buckets. You know,
oh yeah,
and just carts loaded with honey buckets, and so then when we got to Japan, we stayed at Johnson Air Force Base. It was a kamikaze base. Huh. The kamikaze pilots spent their last few days in this beautiful club. They were dined, wined and dined and everything because they knew this was going to be it. And they even had a kamikaze mounted out in front of it. You know, you could actually see what they flew. And we had nice quarters there also. You know, and everybody had their own room. There weren't, you know, there were big halls and little rooms all along.
So while you were there, was the purpose to be standby for Korea in case you had to go back in? Or
I would imagine, yeah. And then during that time is when we transferred over to the B-57, the twin-engine jet Canberra. And I was one of the pilots chosen to come back to the States and pick one up. And I went to Warner Robins, Georgia. And and there happened to be this little girl there who was the secretary of one of the majors on the base, and I ended up marrying her.
So you wowed her, huh? You
impressed
her?
Oh yeah, I was a big hot jet pilot. So yeah.
Well, so yeah. You actually transitioned to the B-57s while you were in Japan?
No. We came over to Randolph Air Force Base in Texas and took B-57 training. The B-57 didn't have any tandem seating, so we didn't have an instructor. We just had to read the manual and just read it and fly it, you know. And they would show us these videos of planes that to get the point across to us, to show us a video of a B-57 taking off and then making a turn and crashing at the end of the runway. And they said, that's what happens if you advance the jet engines too quickly and one will get ahead of the other. So you inch them up as you, like you're doing a touch and go. Mm-hmm. You inch them up so that you have the same thrust out of each engine and you don't have that problem.
Well, how apprehensive were you the first time you took one off the ground?
Well, I'll tell you, after seeing that photo, my first solo with it, when I came around for my touch and go, and I almost ran off the end of the runway.
Oof.
I finally pushed it all the way up and got it off, but I was using up all of that runway, you know. So then after we finished it at the training for the B-57, then we went to Warner Robins Air Base in Warner Robins, Georgia. Mm-hmm. And that's where we were going to pick up I was in a flight of four, and we were going to pick up our planes and fly them back to Tokyo. And they had problems with the plane flying through heavy precipitation, so they had to rebore the engines. It took quite a while, and they also had a problem with the Chinese hat sticking, where you do the trim, you know.
Mm-hmm.
The trim would run away.
This is the button on top of your stick.
Yeah.
Control stick.
Right. For the trim, when you trim it up, you know, the faster you go, the more it wants to go up, so mm-hmm. you have to trim it down. And so that we must have been there a couple of months waiting for all that we're doing, and then that meantime I was dating my future wife. And
so you were willing to stay there for a while then.
Oh yeah, sure, yeah. Yeah, they gave us per diem, and we were in a nice little motel there and everything.
Oh, yeah.
Then when we left to fly back, we flew all the way out to I think it was McClellan in Sacramento. And we were there about a couple of weeks because we had to wait on prevailing winds to make it across. We put extra Bombay tanks, gas tanks in the Bombay where we had bombs. And we had that, regular tanks and that, but still we couldn't make it against the headwind, so to get to Hawaii. So So we finally got the correct winds and made it over and landed in Honolulu at Hickam. Not Hickam, that was the Philippines. Whatever the air base is there. And there again, we were there enjoying it about a week because one of the guys fell off a bar stool and hurt his hip. And he
so, sure that wasn't intentional?
Yeah. So I even did a little, trying a little surfboarding there on Waikiki Beach. Mm-hmm. And then from there, we went to a little island called Johnson Air Force Base. And they had a very short runway, so we had to sit on the very tip end and rev the engine all the way up and release the brakes and hope that we could get off the end because the B-57 had never been in that place before. Mm-hmm. And then from there we went to Guam, and I went to that night. I went to the officers' club in Guam and ran into a friend who I'd been through kindergarten in St. Pete. Hmm. And he was working on the runway that I landed on. And I met him just ran into him that night. That was a coincidence.
So you had no idea he was there?
Oh, no, no.
Oh, that's quite a surprise then.
Yeah, and then from Guam we flew all the way on into to Tokyo.
So you had to refuel three times to mm-hmm. get from California to Tokyo.
Yeah.
Hmm. Now, what was the purpose of the B-57? What was the mission of the B-57 over there in Japan?
Well, the B-57 actually could. Was designed to carry just one bomb. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't know if I'm supposed to talk about it or it's a classified deal.
That's water under the bridge now.
Yeah, and everybody had a target in Russia. Mine was an airfield in Vladivostok, and we had to go and do the target study of the area every time. And then, let's see. I had to stay in Japan a year. So after the year was up, they sent me to Langley. So in the meantime, when I had a 30-day leave and I got married in Miami Springs, and my wife and I went to Langley, rented a house. We were there a year. Mm-hmm. And we did some interesting flying in the B-57 there. We did to deliver the bomb, we would use what was called a LABS maneuver, which is short for low altitude bombing. Mm-hmm. We had a target area on one of the islands in the water there, and we'd come in on the target at 500 feet, and then we'd pull up like this, and then do an Immerman. The bomb would release when we get here, and we'd do an Immerman and go the other way. And they had a dial in the plane. It was a gauge that to keep on course when you hit the target. And it had two needles, one for azimuth and one for G-force. And you'd have to keep the needles crossed like this as you're going up. Huh. And then the bomb, a light would flash and the bomb would release. And then you had to start looking for the horizon in back of you to roll out. And we did that quite often. And I remember one time I did it. I didn't realize it was an overcast condition. I came in, released, and I was in the clouds.
And now you're solid
with everything, the gyros all tumbled and everything. And
oh, gosh.
So I just made a complete loop, and that bomb could have hit me.
Now, the purpose of the lab maneuver was to so that you would be high enough and be able to get out of the concussion zone of the bomb.
Yeah.
Is that it?
Right.
Oh, I see.
And you'd also come in under radar detection, you know. Mm-hmm. So it was a pretty popular maneuver in those days.
And so you were there a year then?
Yeah.
In Langley. Mm-hmm. And then that's where you were when you mustered out of the Air Force?
Mm-hmm.
What did you do then?
Well, I went to Miami with the idea of getting on with Eastern Airlines. Mm-hmm. And when I got down there, I found out that they had just laid off 78 pilots. So I had to look for a job, and so that's when I went with became an agent with Allstate Insurance.
Uh-huh. And how long were you with Allstate?
34 years.
Wow.
Yeah, I only had two jobs, Air Force and Allstate.
Yeah. So were you in the Miami area the whole time with Allstate? Or
yeah. Yeah. I was in, we moved around quite a bit. I was first in a Sears store in a booth. You've seen those in a booth.
Sure.
And right in downtown Miami. And then moved out to an office in Hialeah. Mm-hmm. And then from Hialeah moved to an office in Miami Springs. And then from Miami Springs moved over to North Miami Beach, a place that they named it Aventura. And I was in an office with another agent, just the two of us there.
Already?
Mm-hmm. Okay, Ole, then, when you retired from Allstate, what is it that you're living on Amelia Island? What brought you to Amelia Island?
Well, we were familiar with Amelia Island. My wife has a sister that lived here for many, many years, and mm-hmm. and so we belong to a hunting club up in Ludwigsy, Georgia.
Mm-hmm.
And every time we'd go up there, I'd drop my wife off with her sister and go on up and then come back and pick her up, you know, and things like that. So we were familiar with, we hadn't thought about retiring here or moving here. We spent the last year that I worked just going around Florida, up the Gulf Coast, and down.
So you were looking,
staying in different places and
looking for a place to retire actively.
Actually, we wanted a place on the water.
Uh-huh.
Because we've always had a boat, and we started looking at the Punta Gorda area. Mm-hmm. You know, But then we started thinking about getting into town and getting to doctors and things like that, you know. And we looked all over the place, and then we decided that here, you know, everything is within 2 miles.
Mm-hmm, sure.
The grocery, the doctors, and it's just very, very convenient, and you know, it's close to the hunting camp and also fishing.
Good.
So,
So when was it that you moved here? What year was that?
We've been here about 11 years now. Mm-hmm.
And you're a fisherman and you're a hunter. What else do you do with your time?
Well, I used to play a lot of tennis until I became too old to run around like I used to. But we like to drive out to Biloxi and go to the Beau Rivage and do a little gambling.
Uh-huh.
We really enjoy that. And then we have 3 sons and 3 grandchildren, so we go visit them every now and then. And, mm-hmm. But mainly we just enjoy life right here in town.
It's a good place to live, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree. Well, Ole, is there anything else that you think we need to talk about as far as your experiences?
No, nothing I can think of.
Well, I want to thank you for sharing your experiences with us, and I also want to thank you for your service to our country. And this concludes the interview with Ole S. Swenson, and I thank you very much.